Hello out there. Welcome to Race Talk. And you're here sitting with Trish England and Bob Wallen and our special guest, Bob Varsha. Everybody out there, please mute your phones. I would appreciate that. And I think it's going to be a really rocking, sock'em night. So I'm going to introduce him thusly. With a voice like a fine cup of coffee, our next guest is instantly recognizable, whether he's doing the play-by-play for a Formula One race or a Barrett Jackson auction. His experience and complete knowledge of his subject, delivered in the proper timbre and octave, setting apart from just about any other commentator anywhere in the world. Plus, he's the handsomest man ever to sit behind a mic. A native of Rochester, New York, Bob Varsha was educated at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire and came down to Atlanta to earn a law degree from Emory University. Quite by accident, he soon found himself immersed in the very center of the world of cable TV broadcasting. His first experience was behind the mic for Turner Broadcasting Company, TBS, the Superstation, for the Peachtree Road Race organized by the Atlanta Track Club. He repeated this event from 79 to 2001. During this time, he landed in Dave Despain's weekly series, Motor Week Illustrated, and came down with a bad case of the racing bug. And he was in demand. There was a camera-ready face and a shining personality to go with that memorable voice.
That we can start to open up as business.
We got noise there. ESPN from Bristol, Connecticut, grabbed him to do commentary for IMSA Camel GT series, along with everything from ice racing and gymnastics to snow skiing. Then Speed Vision out of Stamford, Connecticut, teamed him up with Sam Posey and David Hobbs to cover Formula One and IMSA in the greatest ensemble of racing commentary we've ever known. That lasted until Formula One signed up with NBC and ESPN. Since those days, he stayed busy, freelancing coverage of just about everything that came his way. But 2019 and 2020 were not good times for Bob. His health took a nosedive with a double whammy of cancer and COVID, and we almost lost him. But he bounced back, reclaiming the microphone to announce the Ferrari Challenge in Texas late last season. Now he has a bunch of great things lined up for 2021. And here he is to tell us about his life, his career, and his future plans, Bob Varsha. Thank you for joining us, Bob. Knock yourself out.
My pleasure, Trish. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's it pretty much sums things up.
Well, I didn't want to leave you with nothing to talk about.
Well, you know, if I were to comment on it, I would just say that I've been a very, very lucky guy in so many ways. My career was pretty serendipitous. I was just kind of in the right place at the right time. And one thing led to another in the most astonishing way, and I'm really grateful for it. I mean, when I came to Atlanta, I thought I was going to be an attorney, and I was for about 4 years. But it was my personal background as a distance runner that led to my association with the Atlanta Track Club as their first executive director. And with that, you have well, I'll call it the privilege and the joy of organizing 65,000 people running down Peachtree Street on the 4th of July. It wasn't quite 65,000 when I was organizing the race, but it's become a real Atlanta institution that I'm really proud to have been involved with, even though it was so many decades ago. So I did the race, as you pointed out, with Turner Broadcasting, and we shook hands and walked away. I thought that was the end of my television career, and then they called me a few weeks later and asked if I'd like to audition for a job doing news and sports over at Turner. So I went over and got the job, and the next thing I knew, I was doing what they called news watches, little 30-second news blurbs during the commercial breaks of the late-night movies, which left me little time for sleep, but I was young then, and that was fine. And then along came the Motor Week Illustrated opportunity, which was an outside production company, World Sports Enterprises, co-founded by NASCAR Hall of Fame announcer Ken Squire and his partner, Fred Reinstein, a legendary NBC producer. And they needed somebody on the inside at Turner because they shot the show at Turner early in the week, and they would leave a kind of a hole in the middle that had to be filled by somebody to account for all the news that happens between the middle of the week and the following weekend when the show would air. So I got that job, and one thing led to another, and after a stint at CNN in one of the best sports departments I've ever been a part of, with guys like Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick and Kathleen Sullivan and on and on and on, I went across the street to World Sports and said, is there a full-time job here? Law at that point being well in my past. And they said, sure. So the next thing I knew, they were sending me out to the racetrack on the basis of my vast experience, of which I had none, to shoot the races and create little what we call video news releases, just a short summary of what happened in the race that local television stations that couldn't send someone to the race could download from the satellite and use, either with my voice or their own talent on it. So I did that for a while, and, you know, along came ESPN, who tapped me on the shoulder and asked me if I'd like to call the races for them. And I started doing that, and then when the World Sports thing went away, I became a full-timer at ESPN doing all those sports. And then to Speed Vision when Formula One went there, and then to Fox when it developed into that from Speed Vision Outdoor Life. And then I left Fox just a few short years ago to be a full-time freelancer. And that, aside from the health problems that you mentioned, pretty much brings you up to date.
Well, we've got a lot of time left.
Well, I could go on.
You told me that you spent all of your time on planes.
Once you traveled like that. Yeah, I had to admit, you know, back in the good old days, if you want to call them that, we traveled everywhere. I mean, we were the only network, as far as Formula One went, who actually went to all the races. Even the BBC and all these networks that had been a part of the legacy of Formula One, they didn't go to all the races, but we went to all of them for ESPN. Until the early 90s, when we began taking the races one by one and doing them from the studios in Bristol, Connecticut. And, you know, that was a lot less fun from my point of view, because I really loved all the places we went. And being able to, you know, to interview the Ayrton Sennas and Alain Prosts and Nigel Mansells and Nelson Piquets of the world, because you get a much better broadcast, I think, when you can actually look people in the eye and they know you're legitimate. You're one of them, as it were. But, you know, the economies of the day dictated that we couldn't quite go. We did get in trouble once because we did not go to Monaco. And the executives at ESPN thought, what? You didn't go to Monaco? What the heck? So we learned to be more diplomatic about those things in the future. But it did benefit us on one memorable occasion in 1994, on that black weekend at Imola in Italy, mm-hmm. where we lost mm-hmm. Roland Ratzenberger and Senna in race crashes. And they basically put the press room in Imola on lockdown. And so those folks couldn't learn anything about the situation unless someone told them. Meanwhile, we were in Bristol, Connecticut, with all of the resources for news gathering that ESPN had available. And I think we were able to inform people of the situation in a more comprehensive way than the guys who were actually at the track. So, you know, that all worked pretty well. And nowadays, of course, with the pandemic, there's just so much race calling going on a remote basis. And, you know, I'm kind of saddened by that. I mean, I understand all the economics, and it makes perfect sense, and you can get a lot more done more efficiently. But it really... It's really tougher when you don't actually go to the place if you're going to be trying to paint a picture of what it's like and what people are talking about and the weather and, you know, what the officials are saying and everything else. You can do a much more comprehensive job if you're actually there, in my view. But, you know, it's what we're faced with in the current world, so we work with it.
Ed Imola, all of us mm-hmm. remember that day. Mm-hmm. And everything just came to a dead stop for a while, and nothing was happening.
Yeah,
and
terrible.
It was a beautiful spring day here, and I walked outside, uh-huh. and was just shaking, leaning up against a tree. I had the sound on as loud as it would go, even sitting outside. And when your voice came back, I came flying into the house to find out what was going on. It was, well, you maintained my sanity that day, I think.
Well, you know, it really did shake a lot of us. I mean, recall that Dale Earnhardt Sr. got out of his car after winning at Talladega and mentioned, unasked, that he had heard that Senna had been killed. And I know the respect that he had, that he shared with his colleagues, if you will, at the very height of their profession. There's great respect there. I mean, I remember the first time we went to Kyalami in South Africa, 1992. Derek Daly was my analyst at that point. And we went looking for Michael Andretti. I'm sorry, 93. We went looking for Michael Andretti, who had just joined the McLaren team as Senna's teammate. And Senna comes walking into the back of the garage, maybe 30, 40 feet from us. And he looks over at us and does a double take and then comes walking over. Now, this is not something that Senna typically would do, is approach journalists in those days. But it occurred to me, just as he walked up and reached out to shake Derek Daly's hand, that he was doing that because he recognized Daly immediately as part of the fraternity, a former Grand Prix driver, someone he knew about, someone he respected. They were on common ground. And I must say, he was a lot more cooperative and open with us because of Derek's presence. And I think, you know, we see that a lot in this sport, or at least I have over the years, that racers respect other racers, and racers see an event, a race, in a very different way than those of us who haven't driven or haven't been a part of the sport. And I've seen it over and over again, working with guys like Benny Parsons or Bobby Unser or Danny Sullivan or all of the great drivers, David Hobbs, that I've worked with. They see a race differently. I mean, I could look at a million races, but I'm still not going to see them the same way that the veteran racers do. And that's a pretty cool thing. That leads to a dynamic in the commentary booth, if you do it right, that that I think the viewers probably enjoy. At least I hope so.
Do you keep up with Sam Posey?
Irregularly. Sam has been kind enough to keep tabs on me during my treatment for cancer. We don't see each other. Obviously, nobody traveled much in the last year. But
right.
Sam keeps chugging right along.
His health has been good in a long time, but I often think about him.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. You know, they say that that Parkinson's is a disease that takes away the body from a totally healthy mind, and that's certainly the case with Sam. I mean, who is such a brilliant guy, and who, to my way of thinking, has retained all of his faculties, all of his curiosity, all of his talent, and his body has just made it so hard for him to bring that out and to do what he loves. He's still painting, doing some great work in oils. And
how neat.
Yeah. And, you know, his written word is out there for everybody to enjoy. And Sam's another one of those guys. I mean, when I went to interview Alex Zanardi after Alex's accident where he lost his legs in the crash in Germany and was, you know, fully recovered, working with prosthetic limbs and living in his apartment in Monaco and going out on his boat, the Kahuna Matata from the Lion King movie, which perfectly expresses Alex Zanardi's zest for life. I mean, he's the most amazing person I think I've ever met. But I was talking with Sam about what questions I might ask Alex Zanardi. And Sam said, well, one thing you have to be sure to ask him about is how much it mattered to him to be leading the race when he had his accident. And I said, are you sure? I mean, is he even going to remember such a thing? You think that'll be important to him? And Sam nodded. He said, oh, yeah, that'll be really important to him. And so, of course, on the day when I flew to Monaco and sat down with Alex, I said, you know, was it important you to be leading the race when you had your accident? And he nodded and said, absolutely, absolutely. Those were his words. And, you know, then again, it's just that that breed of person, the racers, they're special people.
And I doubt anybody else had ever asked him that.
You're probably right, unless it was another racer. So
true.
Yeah, it's you know, Paul Newman used to say that racers have a special kind of grace, and it's very true. And I've appreciated that. And actually, not just racers, but all athletes. I mean, I could have kept practicing law, I suppose, and maybe my life would have been very different. But I got into sports, and the thing that really appealed to me about it was the ability to tell stories. That and the challenge of going from basically zero experience of sports like short track speed skating or the Tour de France in 2001, certainly auto racing, alpine ski racing, figure skating, gymnastics, swimming, all the different sports I've done, I really knew nothing about when I put my hand in the air and said, yeah, I'll do that. But then I had to get up to speed on it. I had to know who the stars were and what the rules were and the history of the sport and so forth. And that really, really appealed to me. People used to ask me, did I regret leaving the practice of law to go into television? I said, no, not at all. And the fact that I didn't train for broadcast journalism specifically really didn't matter, because I think a lot of the training that I went through in law school was perfectly applicable to broadcast journalism. I mean, you learn to use language, you learn to interview, you learn to research, and certainly the internet was a huge boon. And once again, I was lucky to have come along just as the internet was being developed, and I could go there and accomplish so much in such a short period of time that I wouldn't have been able to do if I were, you know, having to trundle on down to the library and read every book I could find about whatever sport I was going to be covering that weekend, including water ski jumping or whatever it might happen to be, roller disco fishing, as I used to joke. Yeah, but it's been fun. And as I say, I've been so lucky. I've been with so many great sharing professionals, guys like Chris Economaki, certainly Ken Squire, Dave Despain, all the folks I worked with at CNN, and David Hobbs, and the list goes on and on and on. I was lucky in that Turner Broadcasting was a non-union shop, so I could, you know, go anywhere in the building and try my hand at any number of different skills so that I could learn what everybody's jobs were in connection with a broadcast and how I could make the cameraman's job easier or the editor's job easier or the audio guy's job easier. And I'd like to think that that has kind of boosted me along the way, too. I think people appreciate when they think you're trying to make their job easier and work as a teammate to make a stronger broadcast.
You hear from Dave Despain?
I do occasionally. A bunch of us old farts get together, and we have a Zoom call, typically on a Friday. Sometimes there's only three or four of us. Sometimes there's 10 or 12. And, yeah, we catch up on everybody, the guys who worked at Motor Week, some of the guys we've worked with on other projects with World Sports. Yeah, give each other a hard time. And Dave is usually on those calls from his home up in Watkinsville. And, yeah, we have a good time.
What's the most embarrassing on-air goof you've ever experienced?
Wow. there was once on a Formula One show that we were doing from our studios in Charlotte, North Carolina, on Fox. And I don't know what possessed me, but, and you've seen this on blooper tapes everywhere, we started a segment. We came back from break. You know, here we are back at wherever the heck the race was. And I stumbled in what I was trying to say. And I said, basically, oh, that's not going to work. Let's start over. And we were live, and I heard my producer in my headset saying, we can't start over. Everybody in the universe is listening to you right now. And I thought, oh, damn. Yeah, nothing like that had ever happened. I'd done thousands of television shows, and I'd never done that before. which shows what can happen when you let your guard down. But, yeah, there's nothing you can do but laugh it off. You know, hey, I goofed. It's live. Off we go. Thank goodness I didn't say something that I really would have regretted afterwards. No dirty words or anything, just, you know,
well,
keep on trucking.
Well, some people do.
Yeah, some people
well,
do.
Well, considering, really, how many ways an on-air commentary, it's happening
mm-hmm.
so fast, of all the things that could go wrong, that one's pretty quiet. I'm sure you're embarrassed, but... insulting a driver or a team or something, you know, just because accident.
You learn very early on, you treat every microphone like a hot microphone, that, you know, even if you're in break, even if the audio guy says, you know, your mic is dead, even if you turned your microphone off yourself, treat it like, you know, it's radioactive, that anything you say could go out there, because, you know, we've all seen stories of very well-known, famous, accomplished broadcasters who have let something slip under their breath when they thought nobody could hear it, and wound up causing a firestorm. I mean, it happens. That's why we learn.
I want you to finish yours.
Well, now that I'm thinking about embarrassing moments, doing a champ car race once with Danny Sullivan, and at one point, I guess I got lost in some discussion of turbo versus non-turbo power plants in these cars. And I heard myself saying, as though someone else was saying it and not me, that these cars are not turbocharged, which, of course, they were. And I looked at Danny, you know, Mr. Spin and Win, 85 Indy 500 champion, the man who has faced danger with a smile on his face. And he looked at me, and he just went ashen-faced. You would think somebody had pointed a gun at him. And I looked at Danny and simultaneously thought, well, what's he worried about? Oh, what did I just say? So, yeah, there was that moment, too, where I had to
How did you duck and cover that one?
You know, I don't even remember. You know, again, it's the rule, at least my rule is, no, admit it, own it, fess up to it. I have had network executives and producers and such tell me, you don't admit when you're wrong. You know, we are television. We decide what's right and what's true and all that. And I thought, that's nonsense. I don't want to do that. That's not fair to the people who have tuned in. If I get something wrong, I have to fix it. And I've told that with every analyst I've ever worked with, particularly when we're just starting out together. Say, look, you know, it's your sport, not mine. If I say something stupid, correct me. Call me stupid if you want to. I don't care. You know, we just need to get the proper story out there. We need to be accurate and true. So, you know, that's my point of view. And that's how I console myself when I say something silly as well. That was certainly a stupid thing to say. Carry on.
I think the world would open up and I'd just fall into a black hole if I did something like that.
The sun will always come up tomorrow.
Yeah, right. So.
Mm-hmm.
I was asking, what was your favorite co-host or co-commentator or partner?
Wow. Well, you know, 25 years with David Hobbs, I would have to say, you know, probably puts him first in line. David, you know, whenever we get together and chat about these things, always says the thing that he most found remarkable was that we never had a cross word. We never got mad at each other, never argued with each other in, you know, 25 years of traveling the world together and sharing rental cars and dinners and late nights in the bar or tight, awkward, hot, steamy, uncomfortable announce booths. You know, intransigent people that just really ticked us off, except with each other. So I probably have to put David at the top of that list, really. He's just a remarkable guy. But I have had lots of other terrific co-commentators, if you will, through all the sports that I've covered. I mean, Hall of Fame football players, Olympic gold medalists, certainly lots of different fantastic race drivers, Indy 500 winners, guys like Johnny Rutherford, sports car superstars like Scott Pruitt, and the list just goes on and on and on. So many fantastic guys. And then there were the guys, you know, who had success as race drivers and weren't, you know, superstars in the sense of winning, you know, the very biggest events in the world, like the Rolex 24, the Indy 500, the Formula One Grand Prix of Monaco or something. You know, guys like Calvin Fish and Brian Till, who were terrific racers and bring a really sharp perspective. You know, they're great teachers as well as drivers, as athletes. They communicate really well. So I've been, you know, it's another way I've been lucky. I've been with so many fabulous commentators over the years in all the sports I've covered.
Well, you didn't have to do boogity, boogity, boogity every time you did a race.
Yeah, therein lies the story as well. At one time, the president of our Speed Vision Outdoor Life, who was a bit of a prankster, and knowing that the whole Daryl Waltrip boogity 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 thing was, you know, not everybody's cup of tea, let's say, he circulated a company-wide memo which went to one person, and that was me. That said, everybody in Los Angeles at Fox Sports thinks that's so terrific that it's going to be our network motto, and so we're going to ask that all of our announcers begin every race with the phrase boogity, boogity, boogity. At which point, oh my God, my head exploded. And of course, everybody who was in on the joke was waiting to hear what I would say or do. But they managed to stop me before I submitted my resignation. It was, I was totally taken in by that one.
You would have walked for that?
Well, I would certainly have threatened to. I don't know that I would have ever done it, but, you know, somewhere, Jim Libertor was his name, and I bet he'd crack up if you reminded him of that day right now.
You sure it wasn't April 1st?
Well, you know, it might have been. But, you know, it was quite a moment.
You told me about a project that you're involved in for the future.
Uh-huh.
Coming up soon, and I really want to hear all about it. What is Extreme E Championship?
Extreme E is an all-electric racing concept brought to you by the same folks who invented Formula E, FIA Formula E, which is a world championship of electric open-wheeled race cars. They look like, you know, Indy cars, Formula One cars, that sort of thing, open wheel. Extreme E is a similar concept, all electric, batteries generating the equivalent of 550 horsepower, big heavy vehicles, about 4,000 pounds, built like big, like huge dune buggies, great big Continental tires on them. And the idea is to take these hyper all-terrain vehicles to five remote corners of the world that are severely and critically endangered by climate change to call attention to the situation. We kicked off the season, kicked off the sport specifically in Alula, Saudi Arabia, in the Saudi Arabian deserts, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that represents the concept of desertification. The deserts are getting hotter and drier. Water is being used in an unsustainable way. Arable land for cultivation is drying up and blowing away, and that's driving hundreds of thousands of people off the land and into the already congested urban environments that are in turn suffering. So there is that. Our next stop will be the Atlantic coast at a place called Lac Rose in Dakar, Senegal, where we'll be talking about the ocean levels rising and how that's impacting plant life, animal life, human life. After that, we'll be off to the ice fields of Greenland to talk about the melting ice caps and what the implications are for all of us from that. Then to the Amazon, where it's being deforested, burned, lumbered for wood. And then finally to the glaciers of Tierra del Fuego, the end of the world in extreme southern Argentina, to talk about, again, about the problems with rising temperatures and melting ice and how that affects everything. And the idea is to not only call attention to these things, but to propose solutions, which is where the electric competition vehicles come in, because they are non-emissions producing. And there's also legacy programs governed by a staff of scientists who propose solutions to these climate problems through various means. There was some anti-erosion work being done in Saudi Arabia. They'll be planting trees in the Amazon forest that's been denuded by fire and forestry. So these sorts of things. It's also a gender-neutral racing environment. Each team, by rule, has one male and one female driver, and they share the load. Each racer does one lap of a course that varies from place to place, and the winners are based on not so much lap time, but on actual finish in a door-to-door race. Now, in Saudi Arabia, we had some difficulties because they discovered that the dust raised by the vehicles was so great that they didn't want to risk sending the cars out in large groups. So they did single car qualifying and then groups of three for the semifinals, the last chance qualifier, and finally the finals for the event. And it's got a great lineup of drivers, world champion rally drivers like Sebastian Loeb and Carlos Sainz. Sainz has his own team that he co-founded. Sebastian Loeb races for a team owned by seven-time World Formula One champion Lewis Hamilton. Jenson Button, another Formula One titleist, has his own team, and he drives for it. And Nico Rosberg, another Formula One champion, also has a team, and he had the pleasure of beating his old teammate and arch-rival Lewis's team, because Nico's team won the event in Saudi. But the female drivers are spectacular. Molly Taylor is the first and, to this point, only Australian national rally champion. And the list goes on and on. Great, great drivers. It's a lot of fun. The television work is produced by the same folks I worked with on Formula E, so there's a lot of friends there. And the whole series travels in this refitted ship, the old mail ship called the St. Helena, which used to service the island in the South Atlantic that no longer needs a mail ship because they built an airport big enough to land big commercial airplanes on. So the series bought this boat, refitted it with the lowest sulfur fuel engines you can have, and eventually they will make this ship all electric, so that the ambition involved in this project is really kind of spectacular. And I hope folks, if they haven't already tuned in, will do so, because it's a very different kind of motorsport with great personalities, names that you know, and some unbeatable scenery. I mean, these places are just staggeringly beautiful.
How are the courses laid out? What constitutes a lap? How long is a lap? Say it.
Well, it varies. It's totally off road, so the course is laid out based on the available opportunities. And the scientists, of which there are five, I believe, also get involved in making sure that the course will leave no trace, that it will not further damage the location, which is already in enough jeopardy. But it's laid out like any off-road event might be, whether it's the Mint 400 or Baja 1000, and it's one lap. The goal is one lap of about 10 miles. It was shorter in Saudi Arabia because of the prevailing conditions, but hopefully it'll be a 10-mile lap at each location. And each driver on a team will do one, and may the best man and woman win.
That is amazing. Who's building the cars?
The cars are built by a French company in Paris. They're called Odysseys, the Odyssey 21. The batteries come from Williams Advanced Engineering, the Formula One operation in Great Britain. The tires are from Continental, and they're pretty neat. They're you know, one of a kind, purpose designed for the series. And I have to admit, in this first race, we chewed up a few of them. The vastly experienced driver, Stefan Sarrazin from France, rolled one and bent the roll cage, so that was the end for that team. One of Chip Ganassi's drivers, Chip has a team in the series called Seggy TV Chip Ganassi Racing. One of his drivers, Kyle LeDuc, rolled his, and they got it back in the race, and then he was in a special race called the Shootout for teams that have not got a shot to make the final. In other words, they went through qualifying, qualified down low, went into the semifinal round, if you will, and didn't do well enough. So they have a race of their own to decide a few championship points. And in this one, unfortunately, Kyle ran afoul of Claudia Hertgen, a female driver for another one of the teams, who had herself had an accident earlier in the weekend, and they managed to collide once again. So it was pretty wild and woolly, I have to say, out there. And it was extremely difficult with all the dust in the air. But as I say, the course was spectacular. It had this huge 100-meter drop at a 45-degree angle over this monster sand dune. And it was just, to me, it was just magic to watch. I really enjoyed it.
When's the next event?
The next one is at the end of May, whatever that final weekend is, the 29, 30, I think, of May. And that'll be from
IndyCar time?
Well, wouldn't you know it. There's only so many weekends in the year. And, yeah, it's probably not ideal that they picked, you know, one of the biggest racing weekends of the year. But it will also be, 6 hours ahead of East Coast time. So Extreme E will be done well before the Indy 500 or the Coca-Cola 600 for your NASCAR fans. So you can make a day of it. Monaco, the Grand Prix, actually takes place the previous weekend for the first time in forever. So you can catch all the motorsports you could possibly want in all of its various forms that weekend at the end of May.
Let's see if anybody has any questions for you. Folks, open it up. Anybody? You don't usually get a lot of questions.
I unmuted people if anybody wants to talk.
Well, I was going to ask about the Extreme E racing, but I think Trish beat me to it. So.
Who's speaking?
Who's this?
Hello.
Hello?
No.
Any questions about Extreme E that you have?
I'm not sure if you can hear me. You were saying they just run one lap at a time?
Yeah, each driver, there are 9 teams, and each team sends one driver to the line, and that driver does a lap. And then they do what they call the switch, in which they change drivers in the equivalent of an off-road pit stop, which runs a minimum of 45 seconds. And then the second driver goes off to make his or her lap. And the teams can choose which of their drivers goes first as a tactical thing, whether you wanted your male or female driver to go first, I guess, based on who's more effective at a given time. So they put a lot of thought into that. And then, on the basis of those laps. The races are short, and that's something we're coming to grips with on TV. If the race is only going to take anywhere from 12 to 20 minutes or so, we need to keep the action going and the energy up. So it's a developing process. And part of the fun is that we're doing it on TV as we go along in front of the world.
Yeah, I caught part of it on Fox Sports 2 over the weekend. So they look pretty interesting. The cars sound like giant RC cars, I guess.
Yeah, they do. That's the sound, the same sound as Formula One. You know, it's cool because you don't have the roar of an internal combustion engine, which covers up everything else. I mean, Jenson Button said this the first time he got out of his car. He said, "It's amazing. I can hear everything. I can hear it's a four-wheel drive vehicle. I can hear the differentials working. I can hear the tires. I can hear the electric motors spinning up. I can hear every crackle and squeak and everything else in the car." And it's an entirely different sensation.
Anybody else?
I just I looked at the E website, and it looks like it's fascinating stuff, worth spending all Memorial Day weekend watching television.
Sure.
I usually do anyway.
Yeah. Get up early in the morning with your coffee and watch a little Formula 1E. I haven't seen the program schedule yet. I'm not sure exactly when we'll air. But it'll be on the Fox networks.
I wonder if TV Racer has it. In the meantime, anybody?
Everybody's too busy watching them.
They're looking at the website, looking at the new form of racing. You know, I think I'm the only one in California who liked Formula E. And a number of people commented, as you did, that suddenly you could hear other parts of the car rather than the exhaust covering the noise, and listening to the transmission working, listening to the suspension working. It's kind of an interesting thing. Reminded us of showroom stock when all you heard was a tire squealing. You know?
Right. Yeah, it changes hard for everybody, but it's different. And I mean, face it, let's get used to it. That's where mobility is going. We're not going to lose the internal combustion engine anytime soon, but with everyone going electric, you know, you're going to want to get on board as soon as possible.
Now, this coming weekend is the Tesla Day out at Buttonwillow Raceway Park, and they get 150 cars, and Tesla sends down a couple of tractor trailers with charging equipment in them, and the guys get about 10 laps flat out, and then they got to charge them back up again. But it's amazing how fast these things go.
Oh yeah,
if only for 10 laps.
It's instant torque. You know, it's something even veteran drivers, world champions like Button, had to get used to. You know, it doesn't build up its power the way an internal combustion engine car does. That torque is there from the moment you put your foot down. So you need to be ready to go when you do it because the take off. I've driven, you know, electric race cars, and they really are a technical challenge. It's very different from driving an ICE car. And a lot of fun, I have to say.
Anybody out there? Oh, I know there's people. There's a lot of people.
Any Barrett Jackson fans out there? I will tell you, Trish, I'm talking to a network about a project that's really going to take me out of my comfort zone if it comes to fruition. Right now it's simply a proposal, and we don't have any paperwork yet, but there'll be an announcement when the time comes, and it's kind of exciting. I'm looking forward to it.
Now you've got me wondering.
Well, it's going to be.
How was
Barrett
Jackson just recently?
I beg your pardon?
How was Barrett Jackson? I didn't get to watch it. I don't know if anybody else did. But
Barrett Jackson was great. You know, I did it for many years at Speed Vision and then on Fox. Hadn't done one in the last 3 or 4 years, but it was great to be back in Scottsdale. A good crowd within the pandemic restrictions that everybody had to obey. But the cars were fabulous. We had great cars. One of Carroll Shelby's one and only 1966 427 Cobra Super Snake. We He had a Ferrari 275 GTB4, just dream ride after dream ride, and they were all spectacular. A lot of brand new vehicles of one sort or another being sold for charity, all VIN numbers ending in 001. So the first production version of the Cadillac Nighthawks, the CT4, CT5, Nightwing, I should say. Blackwing, I should say. There we go. A new Ram truck that's the most powerful and fastest truck they've ever produced, and lots of different cars that sold for huge amounts of money for charity, which is a big part of the Barrett Jackson operation. And, boy, we raised about almost $5 million for charity. And there were great celebrities on hand. Kevin Hart, the comedian, was there shooting a show. He bought a couple of Corvettes. Michael Phelps was there representing his foundation, David Spade, and on and on and on. It was a really, really encouraging comeback from all the boredom and darkness that we've been through in the last year, to actually get out there and get with like-minded people, car guys and car girls, and really enjoy the enthusiasm we all share.
How is preparing for that compared to talking about a race? Do you have all the notes in front of you on all these cars?
Yeah, we do. And it's typical in auctions, the consignor, the person selling the car, produces what we call the car card, in which the consignor, to some degree or another, talks about the car, its special features, what makes it a good buy. Some people are better at it than others, it must be said. Because it's really, any auction veteran will tell you, it's really important that the consignors say everything they can about the car. Don't just put it out there and say, you know, it's got 60,000 miles and it runs good. You need a lot more than that, really, to have an effective sale and get maximum value for the car in terms of the sales price. So each of these car cards, which is displayed on the windshield of each vehicle when it's on display before it crosses the block, we get a copy of that, and we start our research based on that. I don't need to do quite as much research because I just introduce the cars, and then our experts on the auction block, whether it's Rick DeBruhl or Steve Mignante or Mike Joy or whomever it might be, they need to be able to really discuss the nuts and bolts. And I have to say, all those guys are really good at it. I enjoy so much listening to guys. Mike Joy will say, well, we're not experts, we're enthusiasts, but these guys are about as enthusiastic as they could possibly be. And of course, Steve Mignante is a savant when it comes to these old cars. So it's a great group and a lot of fun to do.
So you've already done some this year. You did the Januaries?
Yeah. I did it was actually just a few weeks ago. They moved it back into March. Because of the pandemic, and they were hoping for the situation to get better, and it did. In fact, while we were there in Scottsdale, the governor of Arizona, Doug Ducey, lifted the mask requirements for people in outdoor areas. So, you know, that caused everybody to breathe a small sigh of relief, and added to the fun on the weekend. May have added to the crowd too, which was good. And whether I'm going to do some more of them or not, I don't know. I was basically there because Mike Joy had a conflict with his NASCAR responsibilities on Fox. So I slipped into my old role as the host, and Rick DeBruhl, who's been doing that in more recent iterations of the auction, he went down to the stage with Steve Mignante to handle the up-close examination of each car as it crossed the block.
Oh, I know. It must have felt great to be back there, though.
It absolutely was. And everybody was so kind and so nice to me in telling me how happy they were to see me back, which I really, really appreciated. I mean, people generally all across the sport and the industry have been so kind. And so curious and interested in my treatment process. And now that I'm in remission and feeling better about things, I hope to get back out there some more and see these people face to face and tell them how much I appreciated it. But it really does a great deal for my attitude, apart from everything else, to get back out there and work. You know, I don't play golf. I don't have a boat. I don't do any of those things. I like to get out there and do my job. And I hope to be able to do that for years to come.
Oh, well, I'm really proud of it for you.
Thank you.
You worked hard for, very, very, very hard for it, and you deserved all the best.
Well, thank you.
Folks, anybody out there? We're getting on down. Okay.
No, I think you can wrap it up.
Well, we're going to skip the next Wednesday week because it's going into the Walter Mitty weekend, and everybody's going to be very, very busy. So our next episode will be Wednesday, May 5th. And our special guest that night will be none other than Dinner with a Racer guy, Ryan Eversley. He's tickled to death to join us, and it's going to be a hoot. Have you ever
You'll
done Dinner with a Racer?
Death. I have. I did early in season one, as a matter of fact, with Sean.
I think I heard it.
And Ryan.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a hoot. You know, as I say, it was very early. I think I was the third guy they interviewed. And to be honest, I didn't quite get the concept. The idea was that you sit there and you actually eat a meal while you're chatting with Ryan and Sean, who are a hoot.
Yep.
Well, I ate before I went to meet them, so I wasn't eating. And I don't know if that threw off the conversation or not, but it really is great. And all the subsequent interviews they've done with so many interesting people from our industry, it's just a brilliant idea and brilliantly executed by Sean and Ryan. You're going to have a great time with Ryan, I guarantee it.
I've known Ryan since before he was born.
Well, there
Literally.
You go.
Uh-huh. His sister, Jamie, is my goddaughter.
Oh.
And guilty by association, we call each other, he calls me Aunt Trish. He's not really my godson, but he's about as close as you can get. But and for all of that, I don't get to see him often, ever, well, hardly ever. Run into him at the track or something like that. But
yeah.
He's a sweet boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't believe he actually. Yeah. And I always wanted to see him get the drive of the century, you know. And I think it still will happen. But he works just as hard regardless of who he's driving for.
Yes,
and
he
he's
does.
A good teacher. He's a good teacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that ought to be fun. And I've got some other folks that I'm working on to join us, and I won't even mention names because I'm afraid of jinxing it. Dave, you got anything?
Interesting thing. We don't know how to do it yet, but you're going to do this some kind of Facebook Live broadcast from the MIDI. And we'll let all you know what the details are going to be once we...
I don't know if it'll be Facebook Live. We'll see how that works out. I'm technologically impaired, and I'm going to be depending on a friend to do all of this stuff because I can't walk and film at the same time. And,
well, there you go.
Much
anyway,
less talk.
Thanks, Bob, for being here.
My pleasure.
I didn't realize you were from Rochester, you know, as is Doug Stokes. And I'm from Buffalo.
Oh, is it really?
So Western New Yorkers got to stick together.
Absolutely, we do. Wow, I didn't know that.
You're from where, Dave?
Buffalo.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's a great place to be from.
I mean, I've been in California 50 years, but, you know. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and turn off the recording, and you guys can continue talking as much as you want because we'll run out of time here shortly.